Well, hello, and welcome back to another scary, scary edition of Ghost Stories Told from the South. I am your host, Stephen LaBooth, and I got some skilly, skilly stuff for you today. All right, man. Sorry, I am late. I'm like a week past, and I should have done one. I just really had to take some time off. These 4 years I've been hitting the grindstone with these two podcasts I have, so I just stepped back for a minute and had to reset and get my mind back on it. But I'm back for good. It wasn't going anywhere. And you will continue to have these every Saturday. So, yeah, sorry about these past couple weeks not being consistent. But thank you guys still for listening, man. And the YouTube page is getting bigger. Go check it out. I'm going to upload some more videos to it here pretty soon. Yeah. So, yo, Gabba Gabba, man. But, yeah, I just want to say thank you. Sorry for not staying on top of everything. But I'm back, and I'm ready for another one, man. So, I hope y'all guys have been good, been great. I hope you're enjoying this weather wherever you're at. Yeah, but I guess we will get on with our stories today. We got some good ones for you, ladies and gents. So, without further ado, let's see what's going on. All right, you know the routine, man. Find you a nice warm blankie. Poke the fire a little bit. Get you some coffee. Maybe some hot tea. Cozy up by the fire and get ready to be scared. All right, let's do our first one. All right, our first story is the Crisis Hotel in Eureka, California. Oh, I'm sorry, the Crescent. I'm sorry. All right, the Crescent Hotel. Purchased on the crest of the West Mountain above the Victorian village of Eureka Springs, Arkansas, is the historic 1886 Crescent Hotel and Spa. The 78-room resort. The 78-room resort hotel is not only known as one of America's most toured places and historic destination, but also renowned for a lot of spirits that are said to continue to walk up and down these hallways and grounds. Built by Eureka Springs Improvement Company and the Fresco Railroad, the hotel was designed by Isaac L. Taylor, a well-known Missouri architect who had designed several famous buildings in St. Louis. 27 acres at the north end of the West Mountain was chosen for the majestic location overlooking the valley. Okay, where was I? I gotta do something real quick. All right, I'm back. Okay. It was an important time for Eureka Springs, historically, as the healing waters of the Ozarks had benefits well known nationwide. Kind of like my hometown of Mineral Wells. That's why people used to come here for years, was the healing vata. People from near and far were swarming into the area in hopes of curing their illnesses and easing their pains. The Crescent Hotel and Spa developers plan to take advantage of these many travelers by building the most luxurious resort in the country. Paul Clayton, or Pal Clayton, a former governor of Arkansas from 1868 to 1870, from the Eureka Springs Improvement Company, to take advantage of its prosperous period. Along with several other investors, the Fresco Railroad joined in on the plan, knowing that the resort could only spur their business. Numerous stonemasons were brought in from Ireland to begin the construction in 1884. Due to the destiny of the magnesium limestone used to build the hotel, special wagons were constructed to move the massive pieces of stone from the Curry site to the White River. Designing an electric area of architectural styles, the Masons built 18-inch walks, several towers, overhanging balconies, and a massive stone fireplace in the lobby. As construction continued for the next 2 years, more and more workers were hired as electrical lights, modern plumbing, steam heating, and elevators, and extensive landscaping, and luxurious decorations, and amenities were built into the hotel. The hotel cost around $294,000 to build, an extremely extravagant amount for the time. On May 20th, 1886, the Grand Louse Crescent Hotel opened amid much fanfare. The local Eureka Springs Times Echo called it America's best luxury resort and hotel. Notable from across the country attended its grand. People from across the country attended its grand opening, including a gala ball complete with full orchestra and a banquet diner for 400 celebrities. Offering large airy rooms with exquisite furnishings, a dining room that once seated more than 500 people, and outside amenities that include a swimming pool, tennis courts, and croquette, among a beautiful landscape of flower gardens, winding boardwalks, and gazebos, the luxury of the hotel was unmatched at the time. Immediately there will do the nations. Oh, to do of the nations to begin to flock to the luxurious hotel. As footmen met them at the Fresco Depot before transporting them to the inn. Once there, the guests could enjoy the healing waters of the spa and stable of a hundred sling-coated horses, tea dances in the afternoon, and elaborate parties every evening, which a full in-house orchestra was there to play. However, the prosperity was not to last. After the turn of the century, people realized that the acclaimed healing waters did not have the curative power that the hotel and the city were known for. Little by little, people stopped coming to the beautiful resort. Oh. Okay, where was I? From 1908 to 1924, the building was utilized as the Crescent College and Convertery for young women, but continued as a summer resort. However, after opening for 16 years, the revenues from the tuition and summer guests were not high enough to maintain the cost of running the large building, and the women's college closed. After sitting abandoned for the next 6 years, it briefly reopened as a junior college from 1930 to 1934. In 1937, Norman Baker arrived on the scene and bought the aging hotel to open as a cancer hospital and health resort. Advertising miracle cures that required neither surgery, not painful extension tests, the Baker hospitalized alleged that its patients would walk away from the resort cancer-free. However, what was unknown to many desperate patients who flocked to the hospital was that Norman Baker's miracle was nothing more than a scam that he had been He had been prying on people, unsuspecting patients, for years. The man had no medical training and was convicted in Iowa in 1836 for practicing medicine without a license. Furthermore, the American Medical Association condemned the many elixirs sold for several different elements, including cancer. While opening the hospital, Baker was being investigated by federal authorities, and in 1939 was finally arrested for mail fraud. Once U.S. Postal Inspector eliminated that Baker had made as much as, or the inspector estimated that Baker had made as much as $500,000 per year selling his miracle elixirs through the mail while in Eureka Springs. Baker was convicted to serve 4 years sentence in Leavenworth. The investigators revealed that over the years, Baker had defrauded cancer patients out of approximately $4 million. While one died from Baker's cure, the investigators showed that this treatment most likely hesitated the death of these suffering from cancer when they did not receive effective forms of treatment. In 1944, Baker was released from Leavenworth and moved to Florida, where he lived comfortably until he died in 1958. During the years of 1940 to 1946, the beautiful building once again sat empty. However, in 1946, the hotel was purchased by four Chicago businessmen who began to restore the old hotel to its former elegance. Though never at levels of its first grand days in the late 1800s, the hotel again began to thrive. Unfortunately, tragedy struck in 1967 when a fire swept through the fourth floor of the South Wing and much of it was destroyed. What did I do with the first one? Oh, it's right there. Okay. Over the next several years, the hotel passed through several hands as repairs and more restorations were made, but it was never fully restored to its original grandeur. However, this all changed in 1997 when Marty and Ellis Ronick purchased the historic inn. In May of 1997, the couple announced, in 5 years, we pledge to have the Grand Lady of the Ozarks back to where she was 100 years ago. But Ozark residents, having heard this promise too many times before, were skeptical. That year, the Ronicks began to rebuild the spas and opened a 6,500-square-foot new moon spa, including Vicky showers, a hydraulic tube sauna massage, and therapy tables, tanning beds, and exercise equipment. The next major project was to restore the hotel's skyline, destroyed in the 1967 fire. Costing well over $1 million, the 3,500 square foot penthouse, originally center observation tower, and the 200-pound, 24-foot-tall crescent moon weather vane were restored. In the meantime, restorations of the guest rooms, lodges, electrical and plumbing, and landscaping were ongoing. On September 6th of 2002, the Ronick's bold announcement became reality. After $5 million in renovations, the Grand Hotel had been fully restored to its original glory. Now, let's talk about some hauntings. Today, the Crescent Hotel is one of the most visited hotels in the South. With its long and extensive history, it is also known to be the most haunted place in the Ozarks. Staff and guests tell of staff and guests alike tell stories of several ghosts that are still said to inhabit the old hotel. The most often cited apparition is a red-haired Irish stonemason who the staff was dubbed Michael. Allegedly, Michael was one of the original masons who worked on the hotel's building in 1885. However, while working on the roof, he lost his balance and fell into the second floor area and was killed. This area now houses room 218 of the hotel and is said to be the most haunted guest room. Michael is a mischief spirit who likes to play tricks with lights and doors, in televisions, and often is heard pounding loudly on the walls. Others have witnessed hands coming out of the bathroom mirror and heard cries of what sound like a man falling into the ceiling. Into the ceiling. Man, that's crazy. Yeah, I don't know what I'd do if I was looking at a mirror and seeing some freaking hands come through. That'd be some crazy stuff there, moondoggies. Where was I at? Okay. Yet other guests have were shaken during the night. In one occasion, a Patreon ran out screaming from the room, professing to have seen blood splattered all over its walls. Excuse me. From the days when the old hotel served as the Baker's Cancer Hospital, the lingering spirit of a nurse dressed in all white is often seen pushing a gurney on the third floor. Only spotted after 11 p.m. when they used to move the deceased out of the cancer hospital. The ghostly spirit vanished when she reaches the end of the hallway. Others who have not seen the apparition have reported the sounds of shrieking screams and rattles that sound like a gurney. The apparition have reported of sound rattles and sounds like a gurney rolling down the hallway. God dang it, where was I? Come on. God, I lost my... Others have not seen the apparition, have reported the sounds of have reported the sounds of high squeals and rattles and sounds like a gurney rolling down the hallway. During the 1930s, the area was used as a morgue, and even today still houses Dr. Baker's old autopsy table and walk-in freezer. The laundry area is also located on the third floor, where a hotel maintenance man once witnessed all of the washers and dryers unexplainedly just started turning on by themselves in the middle of the night. The greedy Dr. Baker's apparition has also been seen in the old recreation room in the basement. Why the frick would you put a recreation... recreation room in the fucking basement. Anyways. Okay, recreation room in the basement. And at the foot of the first floor stairwell, dressed in a purple shirt and white linen, in a white linen suit and looking somewhat confused, the apparition appears identical to the old photographs of the infamous quack. Talking about the Dr. Baker. For a time, the antique switchboard continued to be utilized in the hotel. But when it continually received phone calls from the otherwise empty basement, the old switchboard was disconnected, and it was here in the basement that Dr. Baker hapless patients were often convinced of their miracle cures and handed over their life savings for the treatment. Another reminder of these old hospital days is a ghostly figure calls herself Kim. Most often seen by housekeepers in 419, Kim curiously introduces herself as a cancer patient before quickly vanishing. In the lobby, a gentleman dressed in formal Victorian clothing, complete with a top hat, also often been spotted at the bottom of the stairwell and seating at the bar, described as disgusted looking with a mustache and beard. Many have claimed to intense him into a conversation. However, he sits quietly and never responds before he suddenly disappears. The hotel's crystal dining room is another place in the hotel that is said to contain fragment poltergeist or paranormal activity. Here, other Victorian-dressed apparitions have often been encountered. Many have groups of 1890s dancers in full dress attire whirling around the room in the wee hours of the morning. Other reports tell of 19th century gentlemen who has been seen sitting at a table near the windows. When approached, he says, "I saw the most beautiful woman here last night, and I'm waiting here for her return." A former waitress reported that she spied the vision of Victorian bride and groom in the dining room's huge mirror. The groom allegedly made eye contact with her before the couple faded away. The Victorian spirits that linger in the dining room are said to be very playful. On one occasion during the Christmas season, the Christmas tree and all its packages were found mysteriously moved to the other side of the room. Additionally, all of the chairs had been moved to the circle or face that transported the tree. On another occasion, staff arrived in the morning to find the dining room in perfect order, except for all of the menus scattered about the room. In the dining room's kitchen, the apparition of a small boy has been seen skipping around, and sometimes pots and pans are said to come flying off the hooks for no reason. And on another reported spirit is a young female who once attended the Crescent College and Conservatory for young women, which was opened between 1908 and 1924. According to the table, the girl either jumped from or was pushed from a balcony to her death. Today, guests report hearing her screams as she falls. That would be creepy. Other apparitions have been sighted in room 202 and 424, as well as a ghostly waiter carrying a tray of butter in the hallways. Whether you visit the historic Crescent Hotel to get a peek at one of these many spirits, or want to experience the long history of the luxurious hotel, you gotta come check it out. Oh man, that's another. If anybody's ever been there, let me know. Tell me what you thought about it. I'd love to go visit a place like that. Rich in history, man. Rich in history. That's our first story. Let's see what Stephen LeBooth has for you next. All right, our next story is the Haunted Basin Park Hotel. And guess what? Eureka Springs. The Basin Park Hotel has the destination of being one of America's most haunted hotels, and it's featured in Ripley's Believe It or Not. Located in a quiet and sometimes sleepy part of Arkansas, the owners of the hotel believe so strongly in its resident ghost that they often offer ghost tours for guests interested in learning more about the hotel's history and its haunting past. Most believe that the ghosts of the Bison Park Hotel date back to the turn of the 20th century and even earlier. Men and women flocked to the region during the 1880s because of the so-called healing properties of the local waters. They built small boarding houses with rooms that guests could rent while healing themselves. The Basin Park Hotel sits on top of the charred remains of a former private home that belonged to one of the town's earliest settlers. The former owner's wife might be the woman spotted walking inside the building and along the hotel grounds. Describing as having pale blonde hair and dark blue eyes, she never seems to bother anyone, but clearly isn't happy. Witnesses rarely describe the woman as smiling. Many find her presence deeply unsettling. Her presence is the sharp contrast to the little girl also spotted on the grounds. usually described as a girl between the ages of 5 and 8. She wears a bright and cheerful yellow dress and always wears her hair pulled back in 2 pigtails. Though not everyone believes that orbs indicate the presence of ghosts, the Basin Park Hotel is home to plenty of strange and unusual orbs. Guests sometimes report seeing what looks like tiny and bright lights following them around, and others spotted larger and smaller orbs both inside and outside of the hotel. Photos taken at the hotel show multiple orbs as well. Many different paranormal groups came to the Bison Hotel to conduct research over the years, and many of these picked up voices on recorders, electronic spikes in the rooms on the second and third floor, and other proof of ghosts. Some believe that a few of its ghosts date back to the 1930s when the hotel operated an illegal gambling parlor and served as a speakeasy. Regardless of where the ghosts come from or who they are, many guests leaving knowing without a doubt that the Basin Hotel is haunted. Well, that one seems pretty cool too, man. I mean, I would love to go see an old building like that with all that history. All right, let's get on with our second story. Our third one. All right, our third story is the King Opera House. Guess where? In Arkansas. The King Opera House, which is situated on Main Street in the center of Van Buren's historic district, has been providing entertainment for the neighborhood for more than over 140 years. There have been claims of paranormal activity here for almost as long as dating back to the early 1900s. The King Opera House, which was constructed in 1880 at the height of the Victorian era, hosted a number of famous architects, including Arkansas's native Bob Burns, William Jennings Bryan, and Jenny Lind. The Opera House frequently presented weekly runs of vaudeville performers from the middle of the 1890s through the beginning of the 1930s, on which featured Charles Tolson in the title role. Tolson's ghost still wanders the opera building, where he gave the final performance to this day. All right, here's a crime that happened here. The Tolson Stock Company, a traveling acting group that had been presiding its vaudeville performance at the King House at the King Opera House for a week at the end of September of 1903. It was opened by young, brilliant actor Charles Tolson. A 17-year-old named Allie Parchman noticed Tolson and thought that Tolson would be her way out of the small town lifestyle. In October the 4th of 1903, as he prepared to depart with his troop from the Frisco train depot, Allie's father, Dr. Parchman, learned that a local salesman named C.G. Murray, that Allie and Tolson would be at the depot at 7:45, and their intentions was to elope. As Dr. Perchman waited inside the depot's waiting area, he saw Tolson and cried out, "I want to see you." After hearing his name, Dr. Perchman fired his first shot from his .44 caliber handgun. As soon as Tolson turned, missing Tolson, he would or Tolson, who had started to flee the firing. Another shot was fired by Partsman, hitting him in the back just above the hip. With such force, he turned to face Partsman once more. Partsman fired one final shot at Tolson's chest. He was knocked to the ground by the bullet, which fortunately struck a pocket watch. So he had a pocket watch and it didn't get hit. It hit the pocket watch. Tolson was seriously hurt and taken to Fort Smith by arriving train. There he was transferred to Belly Point Hospital, where he would pass away the next day on October 5th of 1903. Some people think Allie and really fallen at, okay. Some people think that Allie had really fallen for Tolson and was planning to go away with him. But in the truth, he was somewhat hazy. Oh, it's on the back. My bad. I was like, where's the rest of the story? Allie might have wanted to get away from the town and her controlling father. In fact, there were notes in her purse that confirmed this. She wasn't at the station, though, when Tolson was shot. And Tolson was actually happily married to a woman who was a member of his acting company. The local salesman called C.G. Murray, who had given Dr. Perchman this information actually had feelings for Allie and could have arranged the entire incident knowing what could have happened, which heightens the suspense. Here is some of the hauntings they have. Charles Tolson called the Phantom of the King Opera House is only known to have one known photograph. As the last venue Charles Tolson performed at before being brutally murdered by Dr. Perchman. The King Opera House is thought to be haunted mostly by Charles Tolson. Several real weird incidents that have been recorded by former Opera House staff. One of them was the present sense of being seen even while there were occasions where he was alone. A director of the Young's Actor Guild, which used the stage performance at the Opera House, claims that after closing up shop one evening and turning off all the lights, they returned the following morning to find everything had been turned back on. Others have seen the ghost of Tolson in full costume, complete with a cape, a long black Victorian coat, and a top hat. So if you're ever around this area, go visit it. It sounds pretty great. Oh, man. You know what? It never did say if that doctor got away with murdering that guy. He probably did because he had money. All right. Our next story is the Peel Mansion. The mansion was originally built by Cole Samuel S. Peel in order to win his wife's heart. Mary Emmeline had turned down many of his proposals until he promised to build the house of her dreams, one that looked like the Alabama mansion she remembered from her childhood. Colonel Peel. Colonel Peel achieved his rank in the Confederate Arkansas Infantry in the U.S. Civil War. After the war, he went to law school and became a lawyer. He became a prospector and later served in the House of Representatives from 1883 to 1893. Mary passed away in 1902, and Peel remained in the House for another year. The House had a number of other owners between 1910 and 1991, with many putting large amounts of money into or for renovations and upkeep. In 1991, Walmart Incorporated bought the house and then donated it in 1992 to the Peel House Foundation. The foundation then restored the house back to its glory days at the end of the 19th century. They also rebuilt the gardens that surrounded the house. The house is now a historical museum and open to the public. Let's talk about some of this paranormal activity, if you know what I mean, man. The ghost of Samuel Peel is still seen in the house from time to time. The ghost of Peel's daughter, Minnie Belly, is also seen in the house. She usually is seen wearing white and often plays the piano to this day. Should anyone enter the room while Minnie is playing, the music will stop immediately. The house also has a rather unique level of paranormal activity. In the 1920s, Mr. English moved into the house with his wife and children. Two of his children were twins, with one named Marjorie. One day while playing outside, Marjorie was struck with a sudden stabbing pain in her abdomen. We know now that in twins, sometimes the appendix is in one of them. We now know that in twins, sometimes the appendix is in one twin, forms on the opposite side of the body, as it does for the rest of us. This was not known by doctors in 1920. Kitchen tables were eventually brought up to Marjorie's room, and a surgeon opened her up to find the appendix had burst and the infection was spreading through her body. The doctor was so sure the girl would die, he didn't even sew her up, but instead left her with a nurse. For 10 days, the girl suffered a terrible pain before she passed away. Or did she? Excuse me. The nurse pronounced her dead and covered her in a sheet. Five hours later, someone saw the sheet move and pulled it off the girl to find her alive. At the time, it was nothing short of a miracle. We now know the girl must have gotten into a coma as her body made its last-ditch effort to save her. Her surgical wound was sewn up and Marjorie went on to live her life. She would eventually pass away in 2000. God dang, she lived a long time. So, what's so paranormal? Glad you asked. For 50 years, the room where Marjorie suffered and eventually healed was locked up. It seems that the room was haunted by a little girl. Her phantom crying and screams of pain made the room completely unusable by the living. Marjorie did describe what was now called a near-death experience, complete with light. she was drawn into but could not cross. If there is a human social... Anyways. She's seen the light and couldn't cross and came back to life. But man, that would be a crazy place to go visit too, my friends. Ooh, let's get ready for the last story of the day. All right, our last story of the day, guys. It's Highway 36. Some might say that Highway 365 off of I-530 in Arkansas is a bit unlucky. Unless you are a ghost hunter or someone looking for the paranormal experience. This is the case for the area over by Woodson, Arkansas. Populated enough to have a name and a census, but not enough to be its own town. Woodson is technically a design census place with a population of 403 people. It ends up lumped into the Little Rock North, Little Rock Conway area. Basically, Pulaski County, from mysterious unexplained lights to ghostly apparitions. This section of Highway 365 has got it all. Though there isn't any exact proof of this event, the rumor starts with a motorcycle rounding a corner on Woodson Lateral too quickly and passes away on the road. If you sit on the side of the road and wait, you might see an unexplained bright light, like a headlight, rounding a corner and disappearing. Thanks to several other articles about the phenomenon, the only persons with an explanation is a Woodson local called Uncle John. He claims that the light was caused by a combination of headlights, swamp gas, and fog, where the fog and swamp gas would somehow reflect other headlights to give the appearance of a light floating without a source. But that sounds like some Man in Black answer, if I ever heard one. Witnesses of this event sound unnerved by how bright and real the unexplained light is. A first-hand account I heard that provides possible explanation for the normal comings from Mitch H. He shared a story from his teenage years after I asked if anyone on my personal social media page had ever had an experience on Woodson Lateral. Mitch says in high school, we would from time to time go hang out there on the weekends. The guys would take a carload of people that had never been. A group ahead, I think they got a pager alert, would fly a mile or so down the road at or towards the oncoming newbies with a spotlight. About a half a mile out would cut the headlight and turn off on the side of the road. There were absolutely no street lights at the time. So on one cloudy night, it would scare the crap out of them. Maybe the Woodson Lateral lights have always been the product of pranksters. But personally, a group of pranking teenagers is scarier than a sourceless light. Another haunting experience that occurs near Woodson, Arkansas, and off Highway 365 is about a hitchhiker. That story varies from people seeing a little girl to a young woman along the side of the road, seemingly distressed and needing a ride, though this would be heartbreaking to see in real life. The idea of a little girl or even a teenager. Dang it. Distressed along the side of the road and trying to hitchhike seems terrifying enough. Without being a ghostly apparition, in these stories, the driver picks up the hitchhiker and returns his or her daughter's... Oh, God dang it. The hitchhiker... Okay, let me fucking start this all over again. In these stories, the driver picks up the hitchhiker and returns her to her home, where she's directed with a mother or father telling the driver about his or her daughter's death in a car accident a year prior. When the driver returns to the car to let the girl out, she has already disappeared. There is, again, no confirmed family from the Woodson that takes ownership of this story. Though I imagine being interviewed for the haunted for a haunted road would warrant a desire for privacy. So, if y'all have any information on this, man, I would appreciate it if you would send me a DM. Tell me, man. That's our last story of the day, guys. I hope you enjoyed it. Sorry I haven't been consecutive on these, but I'm getting back on being that way. So, yeah. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Go check out my YouTube page, guys. My numbers are growing there. And, yeah, man. And I just want to know. I mean, my numbers are still growing, but sometimes I get people on my podcast and my YouTube channel. They'll stay on and then they'll leave. Then they'll stay on and leave. I don't know what all that's about. But tell me why you left. I'll try to make it better. But you guys, help me get this show out there. Go check out my YouTube page. You can get this podcast on any platform, really. Go check out my Facebook page, Ghost Stories Told from the South. And, yeah, buddy, I think, yeah. So, you guys, be scary. Have a great week. I will see you next weekend. And I might try to throw in an extra episode or two in here, since I've been a lazy ass and not been doing much. But I hope you guys have a great weekend, great week. Be good, be scary. And like I said, slide into my DMs and tell me some ghost stories that you have or a place you would like me to check out. But, excuse me, until then, guys, we will see you later. Be scary. And this has been Stephen LeBooth with Ghost Stories Told from the South. Ha ha. We'll see you later, guys. Have a good one. Bye.